Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Ignorance is not bliss, especially when it is the result of a lack of needed information. That is the whole point of the news media, to keep citizens informed about a plethora of things, including goings-on in government. For centuries, that need was filled by newspapers. They were our watchdogs. They were where people turned to get their daily dose of information, particularly local news. But the digital revolution caused the newspaper business model to collapse. The result is the downsizing of newsrooms and the wholesale shuttering of newspapers. According to a study conducted by the Local News Initiative at Northwestern University, in the United States, 3,200 print newspapers have stopped publishing since 2005. 130 papers closed last year alone and continue to cease operations at a rate of more than two per week. Today, almost 55 million people in this country have little to no access to local news. But there are those working to fill the void. A new report from Northwestern University says 61 new outlets have emerged in the past year. Most are digital, and that's happening as news outlets have also begun to collaborate with each other, and philanthropists have stepped forward to help fund these efforts. This hour, we look at what's been happening nationwide and in North Carolina to ensure that access to accurate, vetted local news continues to be available. Tim Franklin is Senior Associate Dean and the John M. Mutz Chair in Local News at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and Director of the Medill Local News Initiative. He joins us along with Lizzie Hazeltine, Director of the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund. Kyle Villemain is Founder and Editor-in-Chief of a North Carolina publication called The Assembly. And our old friend Glenn Birkins is back. He is Founder and Publisher of Charlotte's Q City Metro. Good morning to everybody. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I'm going to start with you, Tim Franklin, as the director of the School of Journalism and the former editor of the Indianapolis Star and the Orlando Sentinel and the Baltimore Sun. For those who may not think about this a lot, what has been the impact of this decline in the printed newspaper and the business model that allowed for the collection, the editing, the reporting and distribution of news on the scales that on the scale that newspapers were accustomed to doing?
Mike, thanks again for having me. First of all, I just want to say that we're all living through a historic revolution in how news is consumed and how it's produced and how it's distributed and how it's paid for. And that is leading to all of these changes. And I think we're still in the early innings of these changes. But the implications are huge for communities, and I think ultimately for democracy. And I think we're beginning to see the impact of that already. There needs to be more research on this, but the research so far would indicate there's a drop in civic participation in communities where there's either a news desert or little access to local news. And that makes sense, right? I mean, people are not as informed about what's happening in their communities. So it means turnout in local elections goes down, the number of candidates seeking local office declines. There's an increase in straight ticket balloting because people don't know the individuals, they're voting for the party. So I think we're seeing that. There's also an impact in terms of government spending. Research shows government spending rises, government borrowing costs go up in these communities because Wall Street bond rating agencies realize there's no traffic cop. There's no watchdog in these communities that are monitoring government spending. And there's even a study that was done not too long ago that shows that corruption rises in news desert communities. And of course, I live in Illinois, which has a rich history of corruption, where four of the last 10 governors have gone to prison. And we understand the impact of loss of local news and corruption here in Illinois as well. So these are tangible effects on communities. And I think we've got to figure out a pathway forward.
And there's an article in The New Yorker by Nathan Heller that came out, I think it was last week or earlier this week, that talks about how analyzes the previous election and puts it in the scope or in the framework of mis and disinformation and how news sticks to people, and how bad news, particularly erroneous news, tends to stick with certain people, and they cannot be disabused of it. And that's part of the problem, I guess, with the decline of newspapers and accurate information. Your local news report demonstrates that not only have newspapers been shrinking in size and ceasing publication altogether, their readership, both in print and in their digital platform, has continued to shrink. In the past year, you say 500 of the largest daily and weekly newspapers in this country have lost an estimated 2 million print and digital readers. I understand why print readership is down. I think some newspapers, even the Charlotte Observer, would like it to go away altogether. They just like to be digital. But with the ubiquity of cell phones and other screens, how can digital readership be down? Why would it be down?
Well, Mike, that's a good question. And you're absolutely right, first of all, about disinformation and misinformation, which I think is spreading like a wildfire across the country because of lack of local news. So people retreat to their echo chambers and filter bubbles and aren't exposed to news that counters their own public opinion. In terms of the drop of readership, I think, Mike, part of this is there was a big spike in readership and in digital subscriptions during the pandemic. People realized that they really needed local news and information about what was happening with their local schools or local businesses or their local hospitals, the infection rates in their communities. There was really a very significant increase during the pandemic. So I think part of this is we may be returning back to a more normal level of readership. But also part of it is the fact that I think people are tuning out in many cases. There's been a lot of discussion about news fatigue, and people are kind of tired of the bad news. They're tired of negative news, and so they're just deciding to tune out. And they're also, while local news is more trusted than national news, and every survey shows that, it's like people hate Congress, but they like their local congressperson, right? People hate the news media, but they like their local news provider in many cases. But I think there also is a trust issue that the industry has to address to win back the affections of their audience.
Well, there's another example of that too, and that is with schools. People tend to not particularly think favorably of the public schools, but if their child is in public school, they tend to think favorably of their child's teacher. And it surprises me that people can't extrapolate that out to the 30,000-foot view. If your kid's teacher is great, maybe all of them are, you know? Not everybody had the money to fund the publication of a newspaper because it cost a lot of money to print newspapers. Not everyone had money or access to a broadcast license in order to start a radio or television station. And that meant that the news operations of these organizations, allegedly at least, were curated by news professionals who had a set of standards and a set of ethics that they went by. In the digital world, almost anybody can start their own newspaper or television or radio show through podcasts. And some of those people are not going to be good actors. They're going to be bad actors, and they're not going to operate by any code of ethics other than their own. So, why haven't newspaper sites been able to successfully fight against that, given their longstanding in the communities in which they operate? Why hasn't their reputation that they built over the years as a trusted print publication translated, Tim?
It's a great question, Mike. And I think that, first of all, anybody with $100 and a URL can start a news site or a so-called news site. And I think we've also seen the proliferation of these so-called pink slime local news sites. There are now more of those than there are daily newspapers around the country. These are partisan, often owned by PACs and ideological players. So we've seen them try to fill the void. I think directly on your question, I think in some cases, news organizations, which have had very stable businesses over many generations and generations of ownership, have been slow to respond to the digital revolution. I think part of it too, Mike, is that, look, a lot of the revenue that still comes to local newspapers is in the form of print advertising. It's the highest revenue advertising that they have because digital advertising is still dimes to the dollar of what these publications get in print. So the trick here is that they're trying to continue to stabilize their business with print advertising for as long as they can, while simultaneously trying to grow a little bit on the digital side. And I think in some cases, some owners, I'm not saying that this is true industry-wide, but they've hung on and clung to that print revenue perhaps too long rather than embracing the digital side of the operation. And it the other thing, Mike, to keep... Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. Look, a lot of these publications are small weeklies. You know, they're 1-, 2-, 3-person shops. And it's hard to keep doing what you're doing in print and then simultaneously reinvent yourself on the digital side.
It is all about the revenue, because it takes money to operate, no matter whether you print a paper or whether you put it online. It takes money. But it seems to me the economics of printing a newspaper, delivering that newspaper, the trucks required, the printing presses, the ink, the paper, etc., is enormously expensive. Whereas you have a $1,000 computer and a $100 subscription to a website platform and a web designer and some reporters, and you can put a newspaper out digitally. So you don't need the kind of advertising revenues that were required of a print newspaper. Would that be accurate? And if it's accurate, what's the problem here? You can get along with less advertising revenue.
Yes. And so, you know, a decade ago, 80% of the revenue that came into local news organizations roughly was advertising revenue. Now, more than half of the revenue that's coming into local news organizations is reader revenue or digital subscriptions or memberships or donations, depending on the model of the local news organization. But the issue is one of scale. You know, are these smaller news organizations, do they have a large enough audience and can they charge enough through digital subscriptions and memberships to support a newsroom? And that is the challenge that a lot of these news organizations today are facing. And the reality is that a lot of these organizations don't have the scale, at least yet, that they need in reader revenue to support a newsroom. And the one thing that keeps me up at night that I worry about a lot is, especially in these rural areas, 2/3 of all the news deserts in the country are in rural counties, is how are they going to be able to make it without that base of reader revenue support? And that's one of the big challenges that I think we're addressing right now.
Lizzie Hazeltine is with us. She's the director of the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund. It's a philanthropic effort to get money to these platforms so they can pay their writers and editors and reporters and publish their news information. It is less expensive, but it's still labor intensive, Lizzie. Is that the biggest stumbling block then, finding enough money to pay salaries that are livable for these reporters and editors, et cetera, to exist on?
Certainly, labor costs are key to doing this work, because informing communities and making sure that our neighbors know what they need to know, whether it's Tuesday or the middle of a crisis, requires showing up when you're not in a crisis. So continuity of work and relationships with your community so you can deliver on your value proposition of informing them is how you build that base of connection. So you need people. You need people in a place. And you need them to be able to afford to live too. So many of the other forces at work that we see in the labor market also apply to journalists and journalism too.
When we come back from the break, I want to talk more to Lizzie about what she does and the role that philanthropy is playing and will continue to play in these niche publications that are trying their best to fill the void by declining newspaper readership, etc. And we'll meet two of the actors. I don't mean acting actors, but I mean people who are involved in the publication of two different publications that have stepped in to fill the void, and see what get their perspective on what this means to them and, heck, how you can help. We'll come back and do that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. WFAE.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the decline in local newspapers and what it means for communities here and around the country, and some of the people stepping in to fill that void, how and why they're doing it. Tim Franklin joins us. He is the Senior Associate Dean and the Chair in Local News at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and Director of their Local News Initiative. Lizzie Hazeltine is Director of the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund. Kyle Villemain is editor-in-chief and the founder of The Assembly. That's a publication in North Carolina. And Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Kyle and Glenn, I'm going to ask both of you the same question. I'll begin with you, Glenn. Both of you publish these smaller news publications in the digital space. The Assembly is relatively new. QCity Metro has been around, I'm not sure how long, but we'll find out in a second. Talk a minute about why you wanted to start these publications and some of the challenges you have faced in keeping them going. Glenn?
Well, QCity Metro was started, ironically, 16 years ago this month. And I started it to provide news and information to the Black communities in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. When these digital publications first started coming online, I didn't see any that were being created to serve a Black audience, Black communities. And the Black press has always been important to Black progress in this country. And so I wanted to do just a little bit, just my part, to try to see if this would work. Charlotte seemed like a great city to try it. It has a substantial Black population. It has a business community that could support my effort. So I decided to give it a chance.
And you've been doing it for 16 years. So has it? Clearly, you're doing something right. Are you having less problems today? Because I know at some point every startup has problems or faces challenges. Have things improved?
We've improved in some ways. In some ways, we have not. You talked about the drop off even in digital viewership. I attended a session the other week where they talked about the shrinking attention span of online readers. And the presenter talked about the fact that we're in a one-click environment now, where readers don't want to click more than once to get the information they need. And she predicted that in another 5 years, we would be in a zero-click environment, where the news will have to meet readers where they are. They're going to be less likely to go to a website. They're going to be less likely to click off of whatever social channel they're on. So while we've been able to solve some problems, technology continues to present new problems.
It's interesting you brought that up, attention span, because I have noticed in myself that if I see a headline on my phone and I click on it, if they don't give me the answer to the question in the headline in the first paragraph, possibly the first two sentences, I'm gone. I'm out of there. Kyle, let me talk about The Assembly. I think that's relatively new. When did you start and why did you start it?
Yeah, we are relatively new. We're coming up on 4 years. So launched this in February of 2021. My backstory is a little strange. I was not a journalist. I was a speechwriter at the UNC System office. And I was seeing these really complex stories happen behind closed doors, and then reading about it, and the articles were not the kind of as compelling as I was seeing behind closed doors. And I said, okay, we should figure out a way that we can bridge that gap. So The Assembly was launched as a long form centric, which is very apropos to your comment, Mike. You know, attention span and people reading through is a thing we think about a lot. But we are now a 40-person team across the state. And that journey and that growth has been interesting. We started out saying we want to go deep on certain things and kind of be revelatory, do long-form journalism. And that can really only be funded long-term by subscriptions. And what we found is that it's really hard to get a lot of people to sign up for a product that only serves one particular need. And the old newspaper value proposition was that they did a lot of things for you. And so we found that we need to do more things for more people. And that has led us to scale and grow. And we are kind of sprinting through this interesting middle ground where we're not quite big enough to do all the things, but we're also large.
You mentioned that you were a speechwriter. You've also said that you were fortunate enough to hire journalists smarter than you and to envision a new model for state-level news. I'm actually amazed at the people that you have able to coax on board, people from The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal and Huffington Post and Mother Jones and The LA Times. What attracted them to you?
It wasn't attracted to me. It was attracted to the idea that we can do in-depth reporting and enterprise reporting at the state level and city level again. And there were a lot of folks who wanted that kind of old Sunday section of the newspaper back, where you could spend a month on a story and be quite revelatory in your piece about it. And that was the animating force behind us. And a lot of people wanted something like that and joined to try to make it happen.
And Glenn, you came from The Observer and you've worked at other newspapers as well over the years in your career. But when you came from The Observer and you opened the doors at Q City Metro, the paper was more robust than it is today. And I think maybe the Charlotte Post, which is the black printed newspaper, was also probably more robust than perhaps it is today. As those publications cut back by necessity, has it helped you? Are you able to fill the gap?
I wouldn't say that I've been able to fill the gap. That would be overstating the case. Has it helped me? Yes, it has. It certainly opened some doors that might have been harder to enter had they remained as robust. But I think, as Lizzie said earlier, reporting costs a lot of money. Hiring seasoned journalists, people who understand record searches, people who understand how to do enterprise and investigations. And so while we've been able to step in and fill some of the void, by no means are we where I think we should be or where I hope we will be at some point.
Lizzie.
And what Kyle and Glenn have both spoken to is the necessity of more than one news organization, many hands at work together on serving all of the communities in North Carolina. I think Glenn pointed to the long, illustrious legacy of ethnic media, and specifically the legacy of Black press in North Carolina, as something that we're building from. So one organization was never able to serve everyone in a community, even when we had hundreds of reporters. That was certainly an asset, and that was certainly community service. And what we're seeing evolve now is the necessity of finding many organizations that are both willing to serve deep into communities and reach people where they show up on the internet and in person, and then have an eye in their peripheral vision along who else is serving alongside them. And it really is an ethic of service that you hear from both Kyle and Glenn and others across our state.
Tim Franklin.
I just want to follow up on Lizzie's very good point just now. I think what we're seeing is the dismembering of the mass media, which has existed in this country for decades. And audiences have splintered into a million different pieces across many different platforms and many different types of news organizations. And Glenn and Kyle, whether they realize it or not, are kind of on the cutting edge of what is a growing trend in local news, which are news organizations that are serving specific needs of specific audiences and doing it very well in many cases. And at the risk of sounding like a Dr. Doom or a Grim Reaper, in some of the statistics that I was mentioning earlier, we are seeing for the first time in our data, we saw a net increase in digital-only local news sites across the country. There was a net increase of 81. Typically, what happens in a given year is about the same number of digital sites go out of business as that start up. So I think that that's an important trend to mention. And I won't declare it a trend yet. I think we need to see data over the next couple of years. But we are seeing more digital startups, and you know, hopefully they'll be able to sustain themselves in the coming years.
But you do talk about in that report the high rate of churn, the number of startups versus the number of organizations that have started but are now shutting down. And the good news, I guess, is that there is a net increase in this last report. You mentioned, Kyle, the importance of subscriptions, and I want to hear from both you and Glenn about this because I'm not sure where the main source of your revenue comes from, but you said subscriptions are important. And that seems to be a challenge because of the way we got into this digital atmosphere where newspapers were giving it away for the longest time before they decided we need to put up a paywall. And people consuming news on a digital platform became accustomed to having it be free. So how do you get people to subscribe in sufficient numbers to support you adequately?
At the end of the day, it's do you give them something that they need? And if you are giving them news that they can use in their day or in their industry or to shape their understanding of a state, then people will give a few dollars a month or $10 a month to help support that. And that might look like memberships, like an NPR model. It might look like a subscription that gets you past a paywall. But I'm pretty bullish on people's ability and willingness to pay for news. There has to be ways to then get news to folks who are not able to pay, and that takes an ecosystem, and you know, philanthropy will have a role there, as well as will things like TV that are, you know, fairly paywall free. But people will pay for things that they find useful, and we need people to pay for news, and news has to have utility.
Does the bulk of your revenue come from subscriptions, or do you carry ads in the assembly? What's the answer to that question?
Yeah, no. Our revenue mix is some subscriptions and membership, and that's growing month over month, and that's our long-term future. And then some ads and events, and some philanthropy in the meantime.
Glenn, what's the story at Q City Metro?
We're still giving it away for free. We don't have a paywall. We've been that way for 16 years. We want to keep it that way, frankly. I don't know if financially or from a business perspective, if that is the right thing to do. We do ask our readers for donations, but that is an uphill climb. Fewer than 1% of the people who visit our site or read our newsletter actually donate. And typically those are small donations. So our reader donations account for a very small part of our total revenue, and we need to see that grow, frankly.
Lizzie Hazeltine, this is where you come in and others like you, because you work toward philanthropic funding of these news organizations. It strikes me that back when newspapers were strong, they were making a ton of money on advertising. I know what advertising in The Observer used to cost for a full page ad. It was astronomical and unaffordable for a lot of people. And then along come the decline of newspapers and all these other niche publications online, some of which want you to subscribe, others have a paywall, etc. When you were just buying a newspaper subscription, that was probably the only subscription for news that you had in your budget. Maybe you took Time, maybe you took Newsweek, but that was pretty much it. Everything else was free. You got it free on the radio, you got it free on television. Now there are hundreds of these niche publications that need your money to stay alive and ask for it. Is that sustainable?
The sustainability question to me is secondary to what do our communities need to know. Our focus is on resourcing a really wide range of news organizations and community organizations who make sure that our neighbors understand what's going on in their local government, what's going on in their neighborhood, what's happening with their local school. And especially in moments of natural disaster like we are currently living through, especially our neighbors in Western North Carolina, and the public health crisis that Tim mentioned with the COVID pandemic, this local information is essential for us navigating our lives. So I like to invert this and think about, well, we cannot live without this information to have our communities to belong in a place, and sometimes just to do Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday and get bulk trash picked up from our curb. So the sustainability, from my perspective, is more about figuring out what Kyle, Tim, and Glenn have talked about really a value proposition. How can we provide this information that people crave and need and seek out in a variety of places, and make sure that the people providing it are working in organizations that are resilient and can be there for us over time?
I mean, I don't disagree with you. As a matter of fact, I absolutely agree with you. But there are people out there who may not or may not even understand the problem, because they get their news from Twitter. They get their news from Facebook. It's free. May not be true, but that doesn't seem to matter anymore. You are in this business of finding philanthropist dollars to support some of these smaller publications because you believe that local news is critical to a healthy community. How tough a sell is it to find these people who are also being asked to subscribe to all these publications? But now you're saying we also need your philanthropic dollars.
Certainly. And some of the organizations we support don't ask for a subscription, just to be clear. And also, I want to just note that we do support WFAE, and we're grateful for the excellent work that WFAE does. And we're not here because we're a funder of WFAE. But we see many orgs like public radio, like small newsrooms, like folks that do print, but also community orgs who do things like deploy community health workers as part of our network. So the value proposition, though, let me get back to it. The value proposition of local news for philanthropy is that if we want to accomplish anything in our communities, we need to be able to reach people, and people need to be able to see their stake in what's happening. If we don't have that level of connection, we can't work on public health. We can't work on local schools. We can't work on holding local government accountable, because we've lost a critical link in what is a very highly nationalized kind of political reporting environment. So without visibility, without continuity, and without clarity about our stake, we can't get to work together in our local communities.
Glenn, I know you want to jump in. I have about 30 seconds.
Yes, as an individual, Mike, I would want your readers to hear that I believe so much in this mission that I give or donate to probably a half dozen media organizations around the country, including WFAE.
But you're in the biz, so you have a not only a stake in it, but you have a deep understanding of the challenges and an interest in it. I know that Tim wants to... Tim wants to jump in. We'll let him do that when we come back from the break. And I also want to talk about this whole public radio model that some of these organizations are turning toward. We'll do that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about local news today, how you get it. We'll be talking about local news deserts and the impact and what that means to our democracy in a moment. Tim Franklin joins us. He's a senior associate dean and chair of local news at Northwestern's University Medill School of Journalism. Lizzie Hazeltine is director of the North Carolina News Lab Fund. Kyle Villemain is founder and editor-in-chief of The Assembly. And Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of Q-City Metro. Tim Franklin, I know you wanted to comment on what we were talking about just before the break, and that is the philanthropic area of supporting these news organizations.
Yeah, Mike, thank you. And Lizzie, again, raises good points. I just wanted to say that nationally, there's a campaign called Press Forward, which has been announced by the MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago, as well as the Knight Foundation. And that's going to pump more than $500 million into local news over the next 5 years. And indeed, they've already started their grant making. There also are a satellite local news press forwards that have emerged across the country to provide philanthropic funding. And when you talk about solutions, certainly philanthropy has an important role to play, and I think a growing role to play. But I'd also point out that about 90% of all the local news outlets in the U.S. are commercial for-profit local news outlets. So philanthropy can't possibly be the only solution to this problem. And so I think it's going to take a combination of philanthropy. It's going to take entrepreneurship at local news organizations themselves. I wanted to mention the pilot in Southern Pines, North Carolina, David Warnoff, who's the publisher there, who's done a fantastic job diversifying his business model, creating magazines and other news products in addition to the local paper that are helping to support their efforts there. And there are other David Warnoffs around the country that are figuring out new revenue models, which I think is important. And I think we're also looking at public policy as a potential form of assistance for local news across the country. There are about a dozen states now that have either passed or are considering legislation to support local news. I served on the bipartisan Illinois Local Journalism Task Force that enacted a package earlier this year, and next year they're going to be tax credits provided to local news organizations that hire or retain journalists up to a certain cap. And New York also passed legislation. We've seen it in California, Washington State, New Jersey, and some other places. And I think we're going to see more states adopting a public policy solution that allows local news organizations to maintain their independence, which is vitally important, but that also provides some public support.
Are you seeing that happening in Republican-controlled states as well as Democratic-controlled states?
It is mostly right now in blue states. There are purple and reddish states that are considering legislation, and hopefully that will move forward. There are lots of efforts underway right now to try to grow that. And look, this should not be a partisan issue. There are news deserts in red areas and blue areas, newspapers being lost all over the country, both in rural areas and especially in the suburbs, which we haven't talked about too much yet. So this is a national problem that transcends partisanship.
Well, it does, but it doesn't, as we were probably going to find out in the next 4 years. Lizzie and Kyle want to get in here, so Lizzie, I'll start with you.
Yeah, as the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund is the home of these decentralized Press Forward chapters for the state of North Carolina. We're both the home of Press Forward North Carolina and, announced just in September, Press Forward Charlotte. So we're 18 funders strong across the state, from health funders to health conversion funds, who all see this value proposition that I mentioned earlier of community service requires and thriving communities require local news and information. And I just want to say that this work that we've been at the fund has been ongoing since 2018. So we've put more than $5 million to work. And Tim earlier in the call mentioned the specific idea that we are in a transition moment. And part of what I see in my leadership is philanthropy helping organizations have the runway to make it through this transition, to figure things out. The entrepreneurship that you see in Glenn and Kyle and the entrepreneurship that Tim mentioned is essential for figuring this out. And people need time, and time is absolutely purchasable with money. So that's part of our entry point here, especially as we see this renewed and expanded national funder interest in funding local solutions, local experiments, and local leadership.
Kyle.
Well, just an optimistic note here. We don't need every person in the state to pay for news to build a really thriving news ecosystem. And you know, if you get 10% of a state like North Carolina paying $10 a month for some kind of news, maybe that's NPR, maybe that's their local paper, maybe that's a place like Q City or the Assembly. That is an enormous amount of money. And that's somewhere around $100 million a year if you get 10% of the state paying that. And so that's 1,000 journalists at a well-paid rate that let them do interesting things and all the infrastructure around them. If we can build that, that's a heck of a great news ecosystem. And it doesn't require every single human in North Carolina paying for news, just 10%.
Lizzie, I'm glad you brought up that WFAE is a beneficiary of the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund. In the interest of full disclosure, we get a tiny percentage of our income from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We get some money from you for certain specific projects. But public radio, WFAE included, relies on the kindness of its listeners for the bulk of its funding. As you know, that's our business model, and it's one that allows us to report on anything without fear of reprisal from advertisers, because we don't have any advertisers. Is that the model that some of these niche publications are adopting? Will more of them adopt that? Can it work? Does it work?
We're seeing it work. We're seeing it work, thankfully. And that's not the only model that will work. As you mentioned earlier, Mike, and I think Tim also pointed to, some communities will not have the funding or the money or the liquidity to pay for local news as part of a donation, membership, subscription, or other kind of consumer revenue structure. So there will be a wide variety of business models that emerge. We've seen them emerge. And if you look at our portfolio of grant partners across the state, you see those different models.
And Glenn, I believe that you are a for-profit organization.
That's correct.
Do you also accept, have you taken charitable dollars? Do you need them?
Yes, and yes. In fact, we were recently announced as a Press Forward recipient. We were very honored to be, I think the number was perhaps 200 nationally. Is that correct, Lizzie? About 200 news organizations nationally to receive some Press Forward funding. But once again, as grateful as we are for that, that represents just a small fraction of what we need to operate. And so it can't just be philanthropy. It can't just be reader donations. It can't just be advertising revenue. We look at a variety of ways to raise revenue, including live events.
Go ahead, Tim.
Thanks, Mike. I was just going to say a couple things real quickly. First of all, you know, there has to be a value proposition for people to donate and to contribute. One of the things that worries me a lot is we're seeing this growth of so-called ghost newspapers. These are newspapers in name only, many of them owned by large chains that basically have no original local news and information. And so when you go out to ask for subscriptions or donations in that situation, understandably, you're not going to do well. Because there's not much for people to read or to consume in your publication. So I think news organizations that scale down too far are putting themselves at risk of basically just pricing themselves out of the market. And the other thing I wanted to mention, Mike, and it's not because I'm on public radio, but I do think that public radio can be an important player in helping to, and will be an important player in helping to address this situation. Because, you know, in many rural areas or exurban areas, especially where we're seeing the shrinkage of local news organization, there still are public radio stations in those areas. We saw the vital importance of that in Western North Carolina during the hurricane and the crisis that happened there. And, you know, public radio has this trusted brand, this trusted long-time name recognition in their communities. One of the issues, though, is that only about 200-plus public radio stations in the U.S. are doing original local news reporting in their communities. So if we could find a way to beef up that reporting across the country, and both on radio and in digital, I think it could go a long way, especially in some of these harder to reach rural and exurban places.
Because it's very expensive to do, and you need at least a medium-sized market, I think, to be successful at it. I should point out that your organization, Lizzie, the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund, stepped in to really help the folks at Blue Ridge Public Radio in their efforts to cover the damage from Hurricane Helene. Kyle, you wanted to jump in here.
Well, just to say that, you know, the challenge here is twofold. How do we get reporters who wake up every morning and go out and find the information that we need? Then how do we get it to readers in interesting ways? And there's going to be a future where partnerships, where, you know, reporters at, say, small digital outlets are finding news, and then public radio is getting that out to listeners, right? And that's reporting things, getting it to readers and listeners are kind of the two sides of this coin.
You can't do it without people, and hopefully the people have some background in journalism. They've been trained in it. They understand more than just the who, what, when, where, why, how questions. They understand the ethics involved in this. But one of the troubling aspects that we're facing with this decline in local news and this decline in newspapers is the decline in the number of jobs. Glenn, you worked at a lot of different newspapers in your career, the last of which was The Observer, and I believe they've gone through many layoffs and many buyouts of personnel over the years, as have other publications, no fault of their own, just because of the economics of the realities of the situation. Where did those journalists go, Glenn, and what opportunities for newcomers to this business are there?
I think a lot of those journalists left the market altogether. Some went to public relations firms. Some of the big corporations here in Charlotte, for example, they have their own newsrooms, if you will, where they have former journalists producing content for their websites, producing content for internal consumption. So a lot of them went different places. Some retired. So I don't think there's any one. I don't think there's any one place where they went.
Some of them came here. Just to put this into perspective, Northwestern University's State of Local News report indicates that since 2005, more than 266,000 newspaper jobs have been lost. 73%. In that same time, newsrooms saw a loss of more than 60% of their employees, editors, reporters, etc. This is the decimation, it seems to me, of a profession, and in many cases, the decimation of institutional memory, which is often critical for context. Can journalism students, Tim, today, since you teach them, look forward to a career that can sustain them and their families through their lives?
Mike, the answer is yes. And I think the jobs are going to be different. It's not going to be this linear career that I had when I came out of journalism school. I won't say what year that was. But there are going to be jobs. There are going to be different jobs. And there are jobs being created that didn't exist 5 years ago. Social media strategist, social media content producer, multimedia platform jobs. And we're also seeing the students these days are very entrepreneurial. They want to help figure out the solution going forward. And we're also seeing new platforms being created, whether it's on WhatsApp or text messaging or Substack or other platforms that are being created. So, we're still in the early innings of this transformation of local news, but there still is demand, which is the key.
We only have about 2 minutes left, so we're not going to have time to get deeply into the idea of news deserts. We've talked extensively on this program about food deserts. We know what they are. News deserts are the same place, are the same things. They're places where you just have no access to local news. That's the problem, isn't it? Because you do have access to international and national news on these digital platforms, no matter where you live, if you have internet connection, Tim. But what is the impact of not having any access at all in your county or your city for any local news?
Well, North Carolina has 8 news desert counties. There are 54 counties in North Carolina with only one news source. North Carolina has actually been one of the harder hit states in the country when it comes to loss. The implications are people are disconnected. They're disconnected from their neighbors. They're disconnected from what's happening in the local government. They're disconnected from the schools. They turn to neighbors and friends for what's happening in their communities rather than a trusted news source that's vetting and verifying news and information. They're going to Facebook groups, which can be great, but they also become cesspools for rumor mongering and misinformation.
Yeah. Lizzie?
Yeah, Tim's right that one of the things that I actually see as a bright spot, even though North Carolina has been hit so hard with losses of jobs inside journalism as a profession, many of our neighbors have raised their hand to do something. They do it in moments that are dangerous. They also do it when they're frustrated about something and want to see a question answered. One of the basic units of journalism, as my colleague Jennifer Brandel will sometimes say, is the answered question. So North Carolinians are getting their questions answered. And sometimes it is a Facebook group, and sometimes it is the Assembly or Q City Metro or another trusted news source.
One of the bright spots may be the fact that news organizations that used to be intensely competitive are now working together. They are collaborating on getting stories out to local news communities. This news business is unquestionably in distress and faces a lot of challenges. But Tim, I'm going to end with you because I read a quote from you in which you say that you are actually more encouraged now than you were 5 years ago. You have 30 seconds to tell us why.
I think there's greater visibility on the problem. I think the Press Forward campaign is in response to that added visibility and concern about the problem. We're seeing movement at the public policy level. We're seeing more entrepreneurs enter the stage. And so there's movement now that didn't exist 5 years ago.
Tim Franklin is the Senior Associate Dean and Chair of the Local News and Director of the Northwestern University Medill School of Journalism and their Local News Initiative. Lizzie Hazeltine is Director of the North Carolina Local News Lab Fund, excuse me. Glenn Berkins is Founder and Publisher of Q City Metro, and Kyle Villemain is Founder and Editor-in-Chief of The Assembly. Subscribe to them all. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.